Today is Friday, September 3rd, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chino Dorfo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, the United Kingdom seeks resumption of Afghan evacuations.
There are two opportunities to get safe passage for British nationals and Afghans at work for us out of Afghanistan and back to the UK.
Plus, terror attack in New Zealand.
New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said the attacker had been under surveillance before he began his rampage at a supermarket in Auckland.
Also, climate expert warns of more disastrous weather changes. Our top story today is in Afghanistan. Taliban co-founder Mullah Baradar will lead a new Afghan government set to be announced shortly, sources in Islamic group said on Friday, as it battled rebel fighters in the Panjshir Valley and strive to ward off economic collapse. Haibatullah Akhundzada, the Taliban's supreme religious leader, will focus on religious matters and governments within the framework of Islam, another Taliban source said. European Union officials have listed conditions for defining the EU's engagement with the Taliban in Afghanistan. The 27-nation bloc and its member countries have evacuated their diplomats from Afghanistan, but EU officials have said they are willing to cooperate with the Taliban. Following meetings with European Foreign Affairs Ministers in Slovenia, EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell said the bloc will use several benchmarks on Friday to gauge the Taliban's goodwill. They include a guarantee that Afghanistan wouldn't become a base for, quote, the export of terrorism to other countries, unquote, allowing free access for humanitarian aid deliveries and respecting human rights and the rule of law. British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab said on Thursday evacuations of UK nationals and Afghans who had worked with Britain could resume through Kabul airport, quote, in the near future, unquote. Raab spoke after meeting with Qatar's leadership in Doha to discuss the situation in Afghanistan. Earlier in the day, Qatar Foreign Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani said he was talking with the Taliban and working with Turkey for potential support to restart operations at the Kabul airport. Raab told a parliamentary hearing on Wednesday that he was not confident of the exact number of people eligible to come to Britain who remain in Afghanistan.
There are two opportunities to get safe passage for British nationals and Afghans at work for us out of Afghanistan and back to the UK. One is through the airport at Kabul. I had good conversations with the Emir and the Foreign Minister of Qatar here today about the workability of that. I don't think we're yet able to say anything formal, but that's looking like it may happen at some point in the near future. At the same time, we're obviously working with all the countries in the region to make sure that the processing, the documentation, the basic logistics are in place to give us that alternative option. So we're working at pace, and as you can see, we're out here. I'm out here engaging with all of the key partners, and I'll be moving on, travelling wider in the region to facilitate that as well. Well, Ben and I are taking the same assessment, and throughout until very late, the central assessment had been that Kabul wouldn't fall until after the end of August and the evacuation of Allied troops, and indeed there'd be a steady deterioration throughout the remaining part of the year. So we were all working to the same set of assumptions.
That's British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab. Although U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan ended earlier this week, U.S. officials said Thursday there are still diplomatic and economic options for protecting the rights of Afghans under the Taliban rule. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
The Taliban now in full control of the Kabul airport and almost all of Afghanistan. But the Taliban faces challenges as the women of Afghanistan demand respect for their human rights, protesting here in the streets of Herat. And a serious drought sweeps the country, raising questions about how the country will sustain itself without significant international aid. The U.S. has not recognized the Taliban as the official government of Afghanistan. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
No one is saying from the federal government, no one, the president, secretary of defense, no one from the intelligence community, that the Taliban are good actors, right? We are not saying that. That is one of the reasons we are being so clear that we are not rushing to recognition. We will be watching clearly. We have a range of leverage at our disposal, including access to the global marketplace.
The U.S. is working to reopen Afghan airports and redirect aid to directly assist the Afghan people. U.S. government aid to Afghanistan is under review, the U.S. State Department said Thursday, dependent on the formation of a new Afghan government. State Department spokesperson Ned Price.
What we will be looking to when it comes to the issues that you've raised, including the potential for any forms of assistance, will be the actions of any new Afghan government, especially vis-a-vis the areas we care profoundly about. That is safe passage, respect for the rights of the people of Afghanistan, including women and girls and minorities, a government that is inclusive, a government that follows through on its counterterrorism commitments, a government that respects the universal and international norms.
Still outside of Taliban control is the Afghan province of Panjshir, where resistance fighters led by Ahmad Massoud have fought fiercely in recent days. But the Pentagon said the U.S. was not involved in helping the resistance. Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby.
The U.S. military mission in Afghanistan is over.
But an Air Force base in Germany, the U.S. military effort to clear Afghan evacuees to enter the U.S. was accelerating, the Pentagon said Thursday. Commander of U.S. European Command, General Todd Walters.
We're about to become in a position to where we're going to process about 500 or 600 in every day, and we're probably going to have 2,500 to 3,000 to depart every day.
From the fall of Kabul to the last military flight on August 31st, U.S. says it has evacuated 124,000 people, but thousands more remain behind, fearing Taliban retribution. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says the terrorist knife attack at a shopping mall in Auckland was inspired by the Islamic State group. Police shot dead the attacker, a Sri Lankan national who was wielding a knife. Six people reportedly were injured. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said the attacker had been under surveillance before he began his rampage at a supermarket in Auckland, the country's biggest city. Ardern says he was shot dead by the police within 60 seconds of the attack starting.
What happened today was despicable. It was hateful. It was wrong. It was carried out by an individual, not a faith, not a culture, not an ethnicity, but an individual person who was gripped by ideology that is not supported here.
Senior law enforcement officials have said that police officers intervened as quickly as they could after the man reportedly took a large knife from a display cabinet in the store. Videos posted online have shown panicked shoppers running out of the supermarket before the sound of gunfire was heard. The man, a Sri Lankan national, arrived in New Zealand a decade ago, was identified as a national security threat in 2016, and was under constant monitoring. The Prime Minister said his violent ideology was inspired by the Islamic State terrorist group, but although he had reportedly been arrested on suspicion of plotting a terror attack in 2020 and later cleared by a judge, Ardern said there was no legal reason to keep him in custody. She wouldn't give details because disclosure of information has been restricted by the courts. Kate Hannah, an extremism research fellow at Auckland University, told Radio New Zealand the man was most probably radicalised online.
This person most likely has been in that kind of echo chamber for a period of time. He first came to the government attention in 2016, and so obviously potentially since then has been exposed to this kind of material that's caused him to go down this path.
Analysts have warned that the attack will be a painful reminder for New Zealanders of the deadly mosque attacks in Christchurch in March 2019, when a gunman, a self-confessed white supremacist, murdered 51 worshippers. It was the South Pacific nation's worst terror attack. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga has announced he will step down, ending his broadly unpopular premiership just a year after it began. VOA Seoul correspondent Bill Gallo reports the move could mark a return of a period of political instability in Japan.
Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga told a news conference Friday he was stepping down because he needs to focus on his government's anti-coronavirus measures. Suga said it would have taken too much time to do that while also running in the coming election. The coronavirus was a key factor in Suga's downfall. Much of the criticism centered on the Prime Minister's decision to hold the Tokyo Olympics this summer, despite widespread public opposition. Shortly after the games began, Japan saw its worst coronavirus outbreak yet. A recent poll by public broadcaster NHK suggested about 60% of Japanese people are unhappy with Suga's virus response. About 57% said the Olympics were not carried out safely, as the government claimed. Many were also upset at Japan's slow vaccination effort. Corey Wallace, who teaches at Japan's Kanagawa University, says Suga also had bigger problems.
The true fact of the matter is that Suga is not a good communicator by any stretch of the imagination. Even for Japanese politicians who don't tend to be very expressive. And it's just made it really hard for him to overcome all these little problems, all these little, you know, criticisms, all of the, you know, doubts that people have about whether the government's in fully in control or is only just reacting to what comes up at any given time.
Although Suga had only been slated for a one-year caretaker premiership, some had hoped his time in office would last longer. That would have prevented Japan from entering another extended period of political instability. Suga's predecessor, Shinzo Abe, was Japan's longest-serving prime minister, serving for 8 years. In the 50 years before that, Japan had averaged a new prime minister about every 2 years. Wallace says a new period of instability could now emerge.
It's absolutely possible, especially if the pandemic gets worse again, if there's a sixth wave or another new terrible variant or the vaccines stop working or something. Yeah, absolutely. I think there could be a return to the revolving door era. But I wouldn't necessarily proclaim it as the start of this era just yet.
Japan must hold a general election by November. Suga's party, the LDP, is widely expected to retain its parliamentary majority. Though at this point, his successor as prime minister is not clear. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
This is the Voice of America. As they bring war to the other parts of Ethiopia, Tigray fighters face growing allegations that they are retaliating for the abuses their people suffered back home. In interviews with the Associated Press, more than a dozen witnesses offered widespread descriptions of Tigray forces striking communities and religious sites with artillery, killing civilians, looting health centers, and sending hundreds of thousands of people fleeing in the past 2 months. And this week, USAID, which feeds millions throughout Ethiopia, said it has seen Tigray forces looting some of its warehouses. The Tigray forces have denied targeting civilians. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has ordered officials to wage a tougher epidemic prevention campaign in, quote, our style, unquote, after he turned down some foreign COVID vaccines offered via the UN-backed immunization program. State media said Kim told a Politburo meeting the task of virus prevention was, quote, of paramount importance, unquote, and needed materials and technical support and qualified health workers. North Korea earlier this week told the UN that its allotment of Sinovac doses should be sent to countries with severe outbreaks. Its allotment of AstraZeneca doses is delayed. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Dozens of people were killed by floods in New York and New Jersey caused by the remnants of Hurricane Ida, which made landfall in Louisiana earlier this week. VOA's Esha Sarai has more.
Death toll in New York and New Jersey continues to rise after the remnants of Hurricane Ida caused heavy rainfall and flash floods across the region.
We saw a horrifying storm last night, unlike anything we have seen before. And this is a reality we have to face. Unfortunately, the price paid by some New Yorkers was horrible and tragic.
Most of the victims in New York City died when their basement homes were flooded. Many more reported property damage.
I feel very sad for them, but I count myself lucky because I'm not in that bad situation. But still, it's terrible for the community here.
More drownings were reported in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. Despite warnings from the National Weather Service, the strength of the storm took many by surprise. Hurricane Ida made landfall in Louisiana exactly 16 years after Hurricane Katrina devastated the U.S. Gulf Coast.
The people of Louisiana and Mississippi are resilient and resourceful. We're going to stand with you for as long as it takes to recover and allow you to rebuild.
The devastation caused by the storm across the East Coast has led many to question whether their cities are prepared for the increasingly negative effects of climate change. Isha Sarai, VOA News.
A climate change expert has called for the strengthening of emergency preparedness by building stockpiles, improving supply chains, creating surge workforces, and identifying ways for people to obtain aid immediately before and after disaster strikes. Alice Hill, Senior Fellow for Energy and Environment at the Council for Foreign Relations, argued in her new book titled, quote, The Fight for Climate Change After COVID-19, unquote, that countries must mitigate and adapt to survive drastic environmental disasters.
There are steep parallels between climate change and pandemics. And we can learn from this catastrophic risk that is the pandemic to have a much better future when it comes to preparing for climate impacts that are already underway and those that will be coming our way as the planet continues to warm.
How dire is the situation?
For the planet, it's quite dire. We just had a report from climate scientists across the globe, agreed to by 195 nations, saying that the planet is currently warming at a very rapid rate. And if that warming continues, it will have serious, irreversible consequences for humans as well as all other living things. It will change everything.
With the urgency of the moment, do you think enough has been done to mitigate the crisis?
No. Nations have not yet come fully to grips with what needs to be done to cut our emissions. Efforts to remove the harmful greenhouse gas emissions that are already in the atmosphere, as well as undertake the necessary preparation for the type of extreme flooding, extreme heat, extreme drought, and extreme wildfire that we are seeing across the globe today. And those events will continue for the foreseeable future. So we need to have all nations engage in advancing clean energy, better choices to cut emissions, but also to really get ready for the impacts that will come in the very near future.
As concerned as you are about climate change and, of course, what you have in your book, what would you recommend?
Your question gets at the heart of it. We need to start planning, and we need to start planning in a very serious way. That has not really begun to occur across the board. It's a whole of society. It's not just governments, but it's private sector, individuals, and governments as well as communities need to address the two prongs of climate change, which are to cut the source of the heating. And the source of the heating is unequivocal that it's human activity. So we need to change how we conduct business, but we also need to help people survive better the kinds of threats that already are materializing. You can just open any newspaper or turn on your TV or listen on the radio, go to the internet, and you see disaster pictures occurring across the planet.
Currently, the United Nations almost always relies on persuading countries to sign on. Do you think there's more that can be done apart from persuading countries to do something about climate change?
Persuasion is very important. This is a threat that requires more working together rather than less. But we have large emitters, including my own nation, the United States, that could step up in a big way and advance efforts. And if the large emitters, those that have been most historically responsible for emitting carbon emissions, as well as those who are recently joined the club of heavy emitters, if those nations work together, we could materially change the trajectory for the globe.
Some emerging economies, like in Africa and Asia, say it's unfair to expect them to join the climate change mitigation when they barely are responsible for the worsening climate change, and that the bigger and richer nations should take the blame for it and then fix it.
Well, this theme of loss and damage has been a recurrent theme throughout the UN negotiations. And certainly a former judge in world of liability, prior emitters like my own country do bear responsibility for past emissions that have caused harm. With that said, I think the important thing for all nations to focus on is how to help the less financially well-off nations, the emerging economies, to deal with the twin problems of cutting their own emissions as they develop their economies, as well as preparing for it. And that means increasing finance, increasing the available funds to help those countries accomplish those goals.
That's Alice Hill, Senior Fellow for Energy and Environment at the Council for Foreign Relations, speaking with me in Washington. The clandestine sea route from the coast of Senegal to Spain is a dangerous voyage for thousands of migrants. For those who make it, what awaits them is a life outside the law and the stigma of being called an illegal immigrant. Jonathan Speer narrates this report from Alfonso Bieto in Barcelona.
Many of those who survive the arduous sea journey to Spain find work selling fake copies of recognised name brand goods on the streets. It is an illegal trade, and they spend their days dodging the police. Advocates say the migrants' precarious status makes them vulnerable to exploitation. Vanessa Garcia is a researcher who follows migrant flows. She says there is someone or several people there in a chain of corruption who are getting rich from it and are taking advantage, which is the most delicate part of it, of exploitation. And not only of the exploitation of their work, but of human suffering. Some Senegalese migrants have come up with a unique way to address that situation. They formed an association 4 years ago to defend their rights and to comply with demands not to sell fake knockoff items made in China. They created a brand called Top Manta to make original products. The latest, a sneaker. The product is 100% sustainable, made in Spain and Portugal with methods that reduce the carbon footprint. They say their brand provides an alternative to shoes made by large international corporations that they say are not as sensitive to the environment or supportive of local communities. Mansour Jitté is originally from Senegal and is one of the street vendors taking part in the venture.
Nike, Adidas, todo esto, ellos son legales.
They are exploiting the environment. They are exploiting workers. We are not considered legal, yet we are doing something legal, he says. The shoes are labelled Andadem, which means walking together in Wolof, the Senegalese language spoken by many of Barcelona's sidewalk vendors. Again, Mansour Jitté. This shoe is contributing to the economy of this country. The cooperative has had the help of local companies and people like Sara, an award-winning designer in Barcelona. To me, it is an added value, the effort we have all made in coming up with a shoe that is ethical and well-made, she says. Top Manta has helped 120 street vendors, known here as manteros, or mantle vendors, to take their enterprise beyond their canvases spread on sidewalks. The brand's production and sales numbers are taking off and now employs 25 people. For Alfonso Beato in Barcelona, John Spear, VOA News.
Spain's delivery business is booming, plus Hurricane Ida from space and wildfire smoke so thick, satellite imagery captures the damage. VOA's Arash Arabasadi brings us the week in space.
Zero, ignition, and liftoff.
This week, bad weather on Earth delayed by 1 day NASA's launch of SpaceX's 23rd commercial resupply mission. The reusable Falcon 9 rocket blasted off from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, carrying almost 2,200 kilograms of supplies, gear, and experiments to the International Space Station. The next day, the capsule, dubbed CRS-23, docked with the ISS, delivering goods like lemons, cherry tomatoes, avocados, and of course, ice cream. NASA astronaut Megan MacArthur couldn't be happier.
Congratulations to NASA and the SpaceX teams, and many thanks. No one's ever sent me a spaceship for my birthday before. I appreciate it.
That's the most excellent birthday present.
The delivery came on MacArthur's 50th birthday and just days before the first of three scheduled spacewalks. Meanwhile, from West Texas, Blue Origin launched its New Shepard rocket into suborbital space. Space.com reports the uncrewed flight carried 18 scientific payloads ranging from experiments on fuel consumption to recycling and smoother moon landings. The rocket also carried artwork by a rock band and an artist from Ghana named Amawako Boafo, who painted three portraits on the capsule's main parachute covers. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Deprived of their preferred food source, the bananas, peanuts, and other goodies brought in by tourists not kept away by the coronavirus, hungry monkeys on the resort island of Bali have taken to raiding villagers' homes in their search for something tasty. Villagers say the gray, long-tailed macaques have been venturing out from a monkey sanctuary to hang out on their roofs and await the right time to swoop down to snatch a snack. Villagers are worried that the sporadic sorties will escalate in an all-out monkey assault on the village and are taking fruit, peanuts, and other foods to the sanctuary to try to placate the primates. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Makhri Yabaro, and our managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, I am Chinedu Opoin-Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great weekend.